So please join me in extending a warm forum welcome to David McLennan.
Art, thank you, and Foreign Club members, thank you for having me. It's a real honor to be here. I also want to say thanks to the students. There are times when I feel kind of discouraged or despondent about what's going on in the world, and I listen to young people like you, and I'm given hope. I mean, your dreams, your passions, and what you want to be. We're going to be okay with people like you and with leaders like you, so thank you for being here as well. Susan, President Susan, thank you for having me as well. I looked at the speakers list of who you've had here before. I know Nikki Haley was here. It's a daunting list, and I'm slightly intimidated, I will be honest. And I thought of the Groucho Marx line, would you want to come to a meeting that had me as speaker? I probably wouldn't, but you're here, so we're going to give it a go. So thank you for that. And as Susan said, there's a box of Wilbur chocolates. Something about Cargill is we are a food and ag company. You'll never see our name on the label. We're not a branded company, but I would also put in a pitch for its sweetener called Truvia. If you look carefully, you will see the Cargill name on the back, but it's zero-calorie, high-intensity sweetener. It's the world's greatest sweetener. If I'm not pitching our product, who is? So I hope you will take a couple packets for your coffee or your iced tea before you go home. It'll help for sales. I got to be the number one pitch man for our company. If I'm not, who is? I thought I'd just talk very briefly about what does Cargill do. And I would guess there's people that haven't heard of Cargill, but as Art said, we're a very big global company. And like the Medtronic statements that Susan read, there probably isn't a day that goes by when you haven't had something, you haven't consumed something in which we had a role in either feeding or manufacturing or transporting. Like everything from chocolate to Truvia. We're in animal feed, so we feed the industries of shrimp, salmon, livestock. We're in food ingredients. I mentioned cocoa and chocolate. We have a trading business as well, trading and risk management. We also trade metals. We're one of the largest charterers of freight in the world. At any given time, we've got 500 ships on the water with Cargill products on it. We don't own the ships. We charter them. But we're privately owned. And it's pretty amazing. So those of you that come from a family company background, if you've ever read books on family companies, they typically last two generations on average. We're seven generations. So founded in 1865, it's pretty amazing. And you know, people will ask, you know, how did you do it? And I think one of the things that I really respect about the Cargill and McMillan families, and Art will tell you this, they're very humble. They don't want to be in the paper. They love the company and they're proud of the history. But they're also humble enough to say, we don't have the people in our family ranks to lead the company. And I think oftentimes family companies say, it's got to be a family member that runs the place. And they said, no, it doesn't. So they hired professional management. So of the nine CEOs of Cargill, we've had four that were Cargill or McMillan family members and five that were not. And I think that is one of the secrets to the success of the company. I also think, and this is also for our young students here today, that we are a values-driven company. And I used to poo-poo it, like anybody can be values-driven, anybody can have guiding principles. And that is true. But not every company, as we know, you can read in the financial press every single day, companies that go off the grid or lose their way in terms of their culture and their values. And I think that's one way that we have been successful since 1865. Sure, people do the wrong thing or we make mistakes, but we move quickly. And I do believe, as sometimes it may seem Pollyannish, but a values-driven company is one that is meant to last and will last for a long time. As I mentioned, we're family-owned, 95% owned by the Cargill and McMillan families. We have about $130 billion in annual sales, 160,000 employees in 70 countries around the world, and I said seventh generation. The other, I think, key to our success is we can take the long-term view. So the family owners leave 80% of their profits in the company for us to reinvest in the form of M&A or in the form of building new plants, and I'll talk about some of the M&A that we've done recently. They have the long-term view, and yet we run the company as much like a public company as possible. So we have a board structure of six family members, six independent directors who have come from the public world, like Art Collins, who was a great board member for us for many, many years. And we try and use the disciplines of a public company, even though we're private, yet we can still say, you know what, we're not going to do that because we're private. And we don't have all the administrative costs of filing SEC documents. So it's a real benefit and it's a real privilege to have the job that I do. Our statement of purpose is we nourish the world in a safe, responsible, and sustainable way. And it is also interesting to me, it's not only a humbling job description, but as I continue to stay in touch with young people that come to the company, and I want to know, why did you come here? You know, what did you choose? How did you choose Cargill? And it's interesting, I think, about our generation coming out of college in the 60s, 70s, or 80s, and it was about where can my career go, you know, what is are my next steps, how much money can I make. Today's young person coming out of school, they've Googled me or they've Googled the company. You know, what do you do around the world? Are you in the headlines? Do you do the right thing? And it's more about the culture and the value statement and proposition of the company. It isn't to say it's not about the career progression, but it's an interesting dynamic. And as Art said, we've got three kids. Kathleen and I have three kids who are Gen Z and millennials. As you all know, they also are faster to switch companies. So I was I'm the first CEO in Cargill history that didn't work there their whole career. And so it was a very traditional, call it cradle to grave company. I've had three different employers in my career. My son, who's 30, has had three employers in his career, and my daughter's 26. We're already tied. But it is a different, I think, ethos, and it's not better or worse. It's just different than when we were coming out of college. I also became kind of sentimental about being in this job. I'm in my ninth year. I became CEO at the end of 2013. And I listened to my predecessor's Greg Page's speech on your website. So 10 years ago, and I was really struck by the things that he was talking about relative to what I think and talk about today. He was talking about genetically modified organisms. He was talking about obesity and things that just aren't even on our radar screen today. So from when he spoke to you in 2012 to when I got the job in 2013, it's pretty amazing what has changed. For example, trade. 8 years ago, 9 years ago, everybody said, yes, trade is good. It's been politicized. It's become a four-letter word, and it is being criticized from both sides of the aisle. Not only the renewal of the North American Free Trade Agreement, which is vital to the success of the American farmer, but also trade with China. And again, I'll make some remarks about that, about the importance of trade with China to the American farmer and to the American agricultural industry. Since I took this job 9 years ago, I couldn't believe the statistic. The world's population has increased by 700 million people. 9 years and 700 new mouths to feed around the world, which makes our role as creating food and feeding the world, you know, much more challenging, but certainly much more important. Sustainability. It is table stakes. And Greg didn't talk about sustainability or it was in passing, but it is the topic for me, for us today, and for all of the big companies of the world. And that is certainly something that didn't happen then. GMOs, I mentioned, I don't think a lot about GMOs. No disrespect if anybody in the room is anti-GMO, but it's a tool for sustainability. There are no health detriments to consuming GMO produced. Everybody, you all consume GMOs, whether you know it or not. They're not bad for you, but it's just not on the radar screen. Commodity markets. Commodity market prices that time and for many years, prices were very flat, very dull. We trade commodities. We hedge our positions. You need volatility for that to be profitable. It's become much more volatile in the last couple of years. And so that has also changed. And then finally, you didn't have a chief sustainability officer or a chief diversity officer. C-suite level leaders for diversity and inclusion and sustainability wasn't even thought about in 2013. So I kind of marvel at how much has changed in that period of time. I think, as I think about what are some of the biggest challenges and our purpose, as I said, about feeding the world, what's on my mind, and as I talk to other large company CEOs, whether it's business council or other CEO groups that get together, here are the key things that almost all of them are talking about. First, which will come as no surprise, is the global pandemic and the impact on supply chains. I can't imagine there's anybody in this room that hasn't been impacted by supply chain disruptions at some level. I ordered an electric vehicle, a Ford electric vehicle in October, and they said maybe 6 months, probably eight. And have you ever bought a car where you didn't get it in the next couple of weeks? But it's like, that's the new reality. I think about the first couple of days of the pandemic, March of 20, and it's kind of one of those events like, where were you when you realized, holy cow, this is real? And I was on a call with the then President Trump and the administration. They went right to the food industry and said, what do you need to make sure your factories, your plants, your manufacturing facilities are still working? And a lot of it was, we got to keep our workers safe, we got to keep them healthy, but we got to make sure the transportation system works. And it did. I was saying previously that I remember going into a grocery store near my home, I don't know, late March of that year, no soup and no red meat. And so, you know, we took that personally, but we had to shut a few plants because of COVID outbreak. But all things considered, the courage of worldwide plant workers, they had no choice. They couldn't stay home. And so I think people that work in an office have a luxury, which is you can work from home or work for a second home, not the people. And we had half of our employees of 160,000, 80,000 of them work in the facilities. They're still there. And that's why we're able to enjoy the food that we did today, whether it's the chocolates or we feed a third of the world salmon, because of the courage and resilience of the world's factory workers. The second is geopolitics and what's going on. So Art mentioned that I've been to 68 countries. I may have had my last trip to Ukraine. I'm not sure. We'll find out fairly soon, I think. But it's a beautiful country and a beautiful ag country, but certainly right at the heart of political, geopolitical volatility. And clearly we're in times of politicization of trade, as I mentioned, protectionism, countries looking out for themselves, and it feels like we're deglobalizing a little bit, which I would not have imagined 8 years ago. The third challenge that we're all thinking about, big company CEOs, our leadership team, is climate change and climate volatility. It's the impact on where is food going to be grown. It's pretty amazing that the American Midwest has had year after year after year of really good growing weather. But there's been a drought in Argentina, for example, and we're one drought away in the American Midwest of some really crazy prices. I mean, and actually, because of lower stocks in corn, soybeans, and wheat, the three core commodities of the American farmer. Stocks are low. China has been consuming more. They've been importing more corn. But if we had a drought, it would be bad for food prices just because the supply and demand is so tight. The next challenge that we are talking a lot about, and this is one that I think doesn't get as much press coverage, is food versus fuel. So back two predecessors, a guy named Warren Staley, when the ethanol industry was really burgeoning, and there was a lot of talk about, okay, if corn's going to go into ethanol, into your tank, instead of into livestock or into food products, what is that going to mean for prices, and where do you stand, food versus fuel? And Cargill would always say, obviously, we're in favor of food. We're going to make sure that people are fed before it goes into your gas tank as ethanol blend. Big oil companies thought, this is kind of a passing fad, not really going to worry about it. And they were kind of right. In fact, too much ethanol capacity got built. The market kind of crashed. And it's there, but it didn't put that strain on the system. I think that's going to change. And so some of our biggest competitors, so Archer Daniels and Bunge in the oil seed space, have created partnerships with oil majors. We have talked to all the major airlines about sustainable aviation fuel. So all the big companies, the oil majors, all the transportation companies, companies like Boeing, they're thinking about what do they need to do to have greater sustainability, reduce their greenhouse gas footprint, and that's going to put a strain on the food system. So farmers are going to have to be more efficient, or the market's going to price, does it go into fuel or does it go into food? And I think that's an issue that's going to get more and more attention. Next challenge is the growing demand for protein. As incomes grow, it's statistically proven that people want to consume more protein. They want to eat better. They want to eat animal protein. And so that means that there's going to be the higher demand, of course, but there's also going to be the question, an increasing question about how do you sustainably meet the world's demand for protein. Animal protein and ag is a substantial cause of greenhouse gas emission. And as I said a few minutes ago, or I'll talk in a few minutes, the cattle industry and the dairy industry, cows and cattle, emit methane. And so how can we, if there's going to be an increase in demand for, say, beef or other animal protein products, how can we do it in a more sustainable way or a way that puts less strain on the environment? And I think that's going to be one of the key issues for the next 10 to 20 years. But bottom line is, I'm very optimistic we can meet the challenges. I think agriculture is how we'll meet it. There's a lot of technology going into, you know, farmers' systems and into their businesses. And so I'm very, very optimistic about how ag's going to do it. Traditionally, food and ag as an industry has been very slow to innovate. And if you think about all the industries and all the money, venture capital, private equity that's gone into healthcare or technology or the automotive industry in terms of converting to electric cars, it has been pretty slow in the ag and food industry. Here's a stat for you. In 2013, using that as a benchmark, $2.2 billion in venture capital and private equity funds going into ag and food. Last year, $30 billion. So with this pile of capital that's all around the world saying, I want to invest and do new things in technology or healthcare, they're now saying, I want to make ag and food more advanced and more sustainable. And so that's going to dramatically change things. Let me go back a little bit to the pandemic, which I know we're all, I'll speak for myself, I'm tired of talking about the pandemic. It is obviously something that has impacted all of our lives, and so we're choosing to look forward. But worker safety is vital to keeping the food system, to keeping our supply chains moving. We've got to think about how do we manage worker safety, how do we keep them safe from COVID. Transportation systems, ports getting clogged up. In certain countries, if they have one case of COVID, they'll shut the port down. And that has been the case in the ports of Long Beach, which the administration's gotten a little more involved with. But we were recently in Laguna Beach, which is about 50 miles south of Long Beach, and the ships are lined up all the way down the ocean waiting to get in. So things are better on supply chains, but certainly things have not cleared. But as long as we continue to keep our workers safe, we can continue to keep the supply chains moving. I also think, like the example I talked about with no soup on the shelves, no beef, I think people are more aware of how much and how complex food supply systems are, that how many people are involved in the manufacturing of some of the basics. And we all go into our grocery stores and we have this incredible plethora of choices of what we eat. And I think it was a bit of a wake-up call for the American consumer, for world's consumers of, gee, these are shortages here. We don't have that here. But it all comes back to American workers. I mentioned supply chain disruptions. One of the biggest is in ocean transportation. Here's another stat for you. 90% of the world's trade takes place or somehow is involved with oceans, you know, getting from one country to the other. So we had developed a system or technology to monitor ship employees, how long have they been on the ship. In some cases, in the early days of COVID, people working on ships were on for 12 to 18 months. Either they couldn't get off, countries wouldn't let them off. And so we are monitoring, okay, how long have they been on one of the ships that I mentioned are on the water? Because this could be, you know, you need a leading indicator of when you might have a problem when the workers say, I'm not going back on the ship once we unload. So in terms of innovation, in terms of technology, that's one of the areas that we are promoting. I mentioned trade, and if we don't have efficient trade, ocean-borne trade, but it's also things like rivers and all the systems that go into moving food. But going back to the ocean, so we moved about 200 million tons of dry freight around the world last year. And we got it done, but there were some shaky moments, and that included about 100,000 containers. So again, it's the kind of thing you don't really think about when you go to the grocery store, but when you think about all that kind of volume, That's what's going on. That's how it gets to your grocery store and to your table. So shipping delays, costs are a major part of the supply chain issues, supply chain challenges that we're thinking about. Part of what happened is that global businesses, American businesses, became very, very efficient at managing their supply chains. It was a just-in-time approach. You don't want to build up huge amounts of inventory and soak up huge amounts of working capital. You want to have it there when you need it and not try and guess what does the consumer want. But when that happens, you're on a really tight supply and demand reality. And just as we've seen increased demand, decreased supply, that's one of the reasons you're seeing inflation. And that's one of the reasons that you're seeing slower supply chains. Innovation, another area we need innovation is the U.S. ports. So the development of the shipping industry, these ships have gotten bigger. They become more efficient at where, you know, how they're built and how they are unloaded. And American ports can't handle it. Chinese ports can, because they're building them in real time. Our ports are old, and that's why it's good news from our perspective that $18 billion of the infrastructure bill that was recently passed is going to go to ports and facilities. That needs to happen for us to be able to continue to manage the food and supply chain. But it still comes back in large part to labor shortages. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal recently that said 4 million workers in the U.S. have gone missing. We typically have 1,000 openings in our manufacturing facilities. Today we have 3,000 openings. So in the beef industry, so we're the third largest producer of beef in the country, the industry is probably running at 90% capacity. You have to run slower, or you can only run two shifts instead of three because the workers aren't there. Some of it is because of immigration policy that was implemented 5-6 years ago. Some of it is people changing their preferences about where they want to work. And as you can imagine, there's people don't want to work in a meat plant. So it is putting strains, and it's putting, you know, you may have noticed that the price of beef has gone up pretty significantly, and that's one of the reasons that it has. But as I alluded to, we stay close to what are Gen Z and millennial preferences. How are they picking their companies, and what are they looking for in a company? And I think that's really important. I'll talk a little bit about inflation. There are inflationary pressures, obviously. And one of the reasons I mentioned is the supply chain constraints, the shortage of labor. We pay very close attention to that. A lot of it is getting passed through to the consumer and has this snowball effect, but it's not transitory. And I know that was the big debate for a while, is it transitory or permanent? Our view is it's here to stay for a while until things unclog, so to speak. But I think ultimately a connected food system, a global food system, and the presence of large companies like ours, as well as medium and small size companies, is vital to keeping prices lower. And they would be higher than they are if we didn't have that. One of the contributing factors to inflation is the demand for goods in Asia. And that should come as no surprise. But I mentioned about the increasing consumption of protein in Asia. Here's a stat for you. Of the next 1 billion consumers that go into the middle class, 90% of that's going to come from Asia. So when your income goes up, you want to live better, you want to eat better. And people living in Asia are going to want to mimic or more closely follow Western or developing company diets, which means more protein, which means more demand on the system. And that's why I think trade with China is so important, and to keep the borders open. The U.S. agriculture industry, so the American farmer, the three biggest countries with whom we trade and export our products, number one, Canada, number two, China, number three, Mexico. And so that's intuitively easy to see Mexico and Canada and why it's so important. It was so important that they call it the USMCA, U.S. Canada-Mexico Agreement, or NAFTA. That's why it was so important, in our opinion, for that to be passed. But ultimately, the American farmer needs the Chinese market for their soybeans, for their corn. And the Chinese are importing more corn today, but their year-on-year imports of soybeans are fairly flat. We also process, I mentioned, beef, turkey, eggs, and coming back to the American worker, one of our beef plants will feed 22 million people. So that's why they've got to stay open. We've got to have the labor. But it's these proteins are going to feed Asia. They're going to feed this country. And as I said, the demand for protein is going to increase. What does that mean? It means we have to develop, the world has to develop alternative forms of protein. So, for example, we are now in the pea protein business. You may have heard of things like Impossible Foods or Beyond Meat. So plant-based products that ultimately are complements. It's about 1% of the market today. We also have an investment in a company called Upside Foods, which is cellular production of meat. So it's built, basically manufactured in a laboratory. It looks, tastes, feels when you chew it like chicken or duck or beef. It's not monetizable today, meaning it hasn't been commercialized. But these are things that the industry is going to have to do to supplement the supply of animal protein, which is cell-based, plant-based, and people want choices. And I think future consumers, they don't want to just know what's the caloric content, how much sugar, how much fat. They're also going to want to know what's in here and what went into it. So these products have a lot of ingredients in them, and so that's going to have to change too. I mentioned climate change. We've made a number of commitments to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. We have a lot of partnerships with companies like, or entities like the Nature Conservancy, but ultimately it comes back to farmers. One of the things that we're focusing on is regenerative ag. Regenerative ag means building up the soil health for farmers, putting carbon back in the soil. Soil, the dirt, is a carbon sink. So if they plant cover crops, like radishes are a cover crop, you get less erosion. But if you don't till or you reduce the till, it doesn't release the carbon into the atmosphere. So it starts, a big part of greenhouse gas emission and reduction starts with the American farmer. We're also working with ranchers to reduce the methane production of the beef supply system. And I'll talk in a minute about that. And we're helping salmon farmers to reduce the carbon that goes into the ocean, as well as our own sustainability efforts in shipping. So we've got a partnership with a company that is going to build 150-foot-tall sails to put onto ocean-going vessels. So instead of just burning fuel oil or traditional sources of fuel for these big freighters, they can also use the wind. So again, this is where the innovation's going, and that capital I mentioned going into this system, that's what's going to change the industry. It's going to make it more efficient from a lot of different standpoints. We also have this captured a lot of people's imagination when it was in the press. We have a joint venture with a company called Zelp, and it's basically masks for dairy cows and cattle. And it's pretty funny to look at a picture of a cow with a mask on, but the methane production for livestock comes from the front end. Everyone assumes it's the back end. It's the front end, more so than the back end. So if you put on a mask, it can not only, you know, the fibers that build the mask can absorb some of the carbon, but also has sensors to tell us, is the animal sick? Are they getting enough water? And so those are the kind of things, the little things that could go into making a big difference. We're using AI, artificial intelligence, ML, machine learning, all the acronyms that come out of the tech industry, to trace palm, soy, cocoa, all the things that we make. Our bioindustrials business, so it's basically making products that replace petroleum products like fibers in your insulation. Instead of it being formaldehyde-based, they'll be made from canola or other oil seeds like soy. We just bought a company, one of our biggest acquisitions recently, was from a UK-based company called Croda, which makes agricultural-based fibers for industrial products. And then recycled asphalt. So you can put for a binder to keep that recycled asphalt together instead of, again, petroleum or traditional carbon fuel products being made from ag. So ag products, you're going to see them more in industrial products. That is a big part of our strategy. It's going to have an impact on prices. Vegetable oil is going to become more in demand. It's something that can go into fuels. But I think in conclusion, it's a fascinating time to be in agriculture and food. And you know, people could say, well, it's kind of boring industry, or you know, you're growing corn and wheat, you know, then what? it's amazing what's happening. And as I mentioned, all kinds of capital is going in to create technology, innovation, and new ways of doing business so that the food we can produce and nourish the world in a safe, responsible, and sustainable way. So, as I said, I'm very optimistic about the future of food and ag, and I'm proud to be part of Cargill, and I'm proud to be here with you today. So thank you for inviting me, Susan and members. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave. And we have a book about Naples here.
Great.
You've probably seen most everything in here, but
I don't know about that. But
all right, thank you. There are a number of questions. I can't get through them all, so I assume you'll be around a little bit afterwards if people want to ask you.
I've got the time.
The first one I have is not a question; it's a comment. How good your website is, and whoever sent this in is imploring all of you to go to the website, the Cargill website, to learn about how Cargill feeds the world and about other news.
Thank you for that, whoever said that. I'll relay that to our tech department.
There were several on global warming, but I think you addressed that right at the end of your talk, so I'm going to move past that. Several on being private. Given Cargill staying private for so long, how has the company succeeded to do that? In doing that, and will Cargill ever go public?
I think we've succeeded, as I mentioned at the beginning, keeping a strong culture. I think the family is very proud of its heritage and its ancestors. They love being private. They were humble enough to say we don't have the talent, so they hire professional management. Will Cargill ever go public? Well, certainly not in my career time, so that's an easy one, right? I'm in the final chapters of my career. I don't think it'll happen in my successor's time. But beyond that, I think that's our challenge. I think private ownership is great. And I look at my friends who are CEOs of public companies and the headaches that you all have had, and I wouldn't wish that on anybody. activist investors and all the SEC filings that you have to do. So I think if you ask the current family ownership, they'd say no. But I think one day it will be inevitable. But I don't think it's anytime soon.
All right, here's a good one. What has been your biggest mistake, misstep, since becoming CEO?
How much time do we have? I've read a lot of books on leadership in my career. I just have enjoyed studying leadership, both academically reading the books, but I also like watching people in leadership positions, whether it's nonprofits or C-suite or divisional, and say, how did they get here and how did they become successful? What are the qualities? Is it they're brilliant? Is it they're great with people? Is it they're intuitive? What is it? And one of the things in the books that I read about former CEOs, and the thing that they said, there are a couple of different themes, and I can relate to these themes. This isn't about a mistake, but the first is, in your first year, I don't know if you would agree, you really don't know what you're doing in a CEO job. It's overwhelming. Everything changes. Your jokes are funnier. People write down what you say. People are asking you to come to the You didn't ask me in my first year, but you asked me in my ninth year, so I appreciate that. But I think part of it is getting used to the job. But I think the speed with which you make some really important decisions, especially leadership position decisions, listen to your inner voice. That's always been my advice to people, that you're successful for a reason. You're here for a reason. Trust your intuition and act upon it, because sometimes I think you want to analyze it, think about it, pros, cons. Go with your gut. And if you make a mistake, unwind the mistake. So I'd say on some key personnel leadership positions, I didn't move as fast as I should have, despite having read the books that said, make sure you move faster than you think you need to.
All right. Coming back to protein and meat, do you think first world countries will still be consuming meat 100 years from now?
Yeah. No, I don't. Let me rephrase it. In 100 years from now, You know, wealthy countries, I think animal protein, raising animals for the consumption of meat will be a minority of the way protein is consumed. And it might be pea protein, it might be cellular based, it might be bugs. There's all forms of proteins from different sources, but I think over that period of time, the world's going to realize I can get the same flavor, taste, mouthfeel, chewiness experience, but without the taxation on the environment. Think about beef, pork, chicken, salmon, the time and the resources that go into raising it and then consuming it and processing it. It can be done easier, and I think in 100 years, it won't be gone, but I think it'll be the other balance. I mentioned 1% plant. I think it could be 199, but that's a long time from now. I won't be here.
All right. You addressed Cargill's trading business.
Yep.
Over your time as CEO, how has the trading culture and trading process changed? And there's a PS here. Thanks for taking care of my position. And then related,
was that you,
has your
Kathleen?
Commodity hedging materially increased due to inflation, and if so, by what degree?
So I would say that with trading, what's changed is technology. So back in the day, which was as recent as 2010, you know, we had this really good network around the world of working with farmers. We would see stuff, we would see trends. And in the wheat crisis, there was a Russian wheat crisis in 2011. And our people dealing with Russian wheat farmers said, there's a really bad drought in Russia right now. It's way worse than anybody has realized. They're going to embargo wheat. It's going to send prices skyrocketing for wheat substitutes, for wheat, for sorghum. And we got in front of that. So for our customers, were able to hedge the price. And sure enough, that's what happened. You know, information and data is so plentiful today, you really can't pick up that edge anymore. Back in the day, say the 70s and 80s and 90s, I mean, our wire network, you know, pre-internet, we had more, the CIA used to call us to say, what's going on in Eastern Europe or behind the Iron Curtain? Because we had better information than the government did. Information and data is, and some forms of data is a commodity. So now we own our own satellite company. So we have to put our own satellites up. So I'd say that's what's changed, is it's less the informal network or our network, and it's more about technology and data. And then in terms of last point is, who are we hiring? Instead of hiring kids out of university and college, I look at the profiles. We're hiring data scientists, PhDs in chemistry, PhDs in data management. I mean, people, and I look at the young people here today, I'm really glad I'm not competing with you. I could not compete with you, but what you will do and what you will know and the knowledge and degrees that you'll get didn't exist, like PhDs in supply chain management. So the level of technology and who we're hiring is way different than it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
Okay, we only have time for two more, and we have many more than that. What is the major reason for the increase in soybean prices?
There's a couple of things. One is the pull from China. So last year, the U.S. government retooled its trade agreement, you know, from the trade embargo. And so the Chinese said, okay, we'll commit to buying these kind of volumes. And it set prices way higher, you know, just the pull going to China, huge amounts going. This year, it's not as much as it was. It's not as much in 2021 as it was in 2020. So the pull from China is one. As I mentioned before, food versus fuel. So production of vegetable oil being as a food substitute, biodiesel. So we're building, for example, we're building a plant in Nebraska in a joint venture with Love's Travel Stops to make biodiesel from beef tallow. But how does that relate to soybean oil? Again, it's going into more energy sources. And then margins when you crush soybeans to sell meal, which feeds livestock, and oil, which can be energy or cooking oil, soybean margins are very good. So it's paying handsomely to get the soybeans, crush them, and make the profit from the margins, pull from China, and lower stocks too. So there's a more of a tight supply and demand relationship in soy.
All right, last one that we have time for, and coming back to the labor shortage. Do you use robots or robotics in any of your manufacturing facilities, and if so, what type?
Yeah, we do use robots and robotics. So, for example, at our beef processing facilities, where you're herding the cattle into the chutes before they go into the plant, we do have a robot, which is, it's dangerous work, obviously. So we do have a robot that helps herd the cattle. We have a chicken plant, for example, in the UK, which has got an electronic eye, and it plucks the pieces of chicken based on color and size and shape to put it onto a tray pack that then gets wrapped in cellophane. So yes, we use robotics. There's two examples. But I think what this has shown us is that automation, so one shift in a plant that feeds 22 million people, a beef plant, 1,000 people, which is a huge number of people. So you get 1,000 people coming in, second shift. But it shows that we're going to need, it's going to intensify automation. It's going to intensify the use of robotics. Some of the jobs in a beef plant are very highly skilled. People make very good money, you know, if they're cutting off the specialty cuts, whether it's for your filet or your T-bone or your strip or whatever it is. But some of it is very manual, but it also means those jobs are going to go away. So I think, like everything else, COVID is going to accelerate the use of technology and robotics in our food plants.
Okay, I think I speak for everyone in the room in hoping that the next time we have you back,
thank you.
It will be as a member. Thanks for not speaking.
Thanks, Art. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.